Hey Boo Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Keys, Beats, Bars community discussion on Sunday, July 8th from 3 to 5 p.m. at the Social Justice Action Center in Portland. Keys, Beats, Bars is a music program for incarcerated youth. This community discussion will be about how music empowerment can bring the community together and to learn about volunteer opportunities and general information about Keys, Beats, Bars, Morpheus Youth Project, Liberation Literary, and many others. Again, that's the Keys, Beats, Bars community discussion on Sunday, July 8th from 3 to 5 p.m. at the Social Justice Action Center, 400 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, where the time is 9:01, and that's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Margaridge, hosting today's show, along with our engineer, Patsy Kullberg. The mole is the beast that works underground and then pops up unexpectedly in the manicured landscapes of the well-to-do. Karl Marx compared the work of the mole to the revolution of the people, who organize and then rise up to contest and even one day overthrow the system of exploitation and expropriation known as capitalism. Capitalism depends on the nation-state for many things, including organizing and defending its way of doing business in the world. Thus, the state regulates and limits the ability of workers to organize to minimize their exploitation. It funnels profits to major corporations for the production of war and security materiel and for building and operating camps and prisons for the enemies of the state. The nation-state, of course, is only a social construct, and yet it must command the loyalty and even the veneration of most of its people, since the state must frequently require its people to lay down their lives on the battlefield for its preservation and honor. And it is precisely the mountains of the dead left on battlefields that make the state real and revered by its people. We are encouraged to believe, as the Roman poet Horace put it, that it is sweet and proper to die for the fatherland, or as we now say, the homeland, and that so many have died for it makes us believe that it must be real, since it is taboo to think that all those soldiers died for an illusion. But another way the state can make itself seem real in the eyes of its people is by making a spectacular defense of its borders against people it demonizes as outsiders, enemies, alien people. That, of course, is what's happening on our southern border today. The nation state that calls itself America and that has historically conceived of itself as white is trying to make itself great by militarizing the arbitrary line between itself and the peoples of other American nations. Today's Old Mole Show approaches the border issue from two perspectives. First, we hear from some of the Portland folks who are trying to shut down the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE, by camping and demonstrating at the ICE headquarters down on McAdam Avenue. And that will be followed by a discussion of the new animated film Coco. It's billed as a love letter to Mexico, and the story speaks to the current trauma of family separation at the U.S.-Mexico border. We will then turn to a case where the capitalist state works to restrain the ability of workers to organize, particularly state workers, and we will hear about the struggles by Wisconsin state employees to keep their union going after the assault on unions by Governor Scott Walker and the Republican state legislature. So that's what's in store for you in the next hour. If you miss any of it or want to hear it again or recommend it to your friends, our show is archived on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Today's show should be up in a day or two. If you're on Facebook, please find us and like us there, and you'll get frequent updates about the show. And now, leading off today's show, Field Mole Desiree Helliger speaks with activists at Occupy ICE PDX about the action that began on the evening of June 17th, Father's Day, and helped touch off a nationwide movement to occupy and abolish immigration and customs enforcement.
Friday, June 22nd.
Antonio Zamora, I happened to be here on Father's Day when, after the Democratic Socialists of America rally got done, there were some folks hanging still around the ICE office, and I think you kind of initiated a general assembly to talk a little bit about strategy, and this ICE occupation, occupying ICE, came out of that conversation.
Yeah, after the DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, had the rally, very, very powerful rally with very strong words spoken about this issue of how people are treated in the ICE detentions across this country, how children were locked up in essentially large dog kennels, which is still likely happening right now. This vigil became a mass vigil in several occasions here, and many people have come out and listened. First morning, I was woken up by a camera crew. I stood around for maybe an hour after I woke up. You see, I actually work 50 hours a week. I work at two different locations in the city of Portland. I'm very committed in my life to make a world difference. I work as a farmer. I am a farmer. I'm learning how to be a farmer. And I work as a dispatcher at a day labor center for international workers' rights. This life of creating beautiful trouble is worth risking my life, because I wish to see dreams come true and the world to change. So now here we are on the second day, if I may continue saying, and the second day there were probably about 100 people, vaguely speaking. And then after that, on the third day, there was like 1,000 people. This Cien Gente came, you know, like 1,000 people came out, and it was just like, wow. I really just believe spirit brought us together out of prayer. And I really believe if we keep the prayers up, people will come. So please pray for the vigil. Pray for the country, to pray for its sins of 527 years. Pray for the families to come back together and release out of jail, out of ICE custody right now. Pray for this whole nation to come together and move past violence more and more every day. Pray for ICE detention centers across the nation to have more occupations as there are growing right now. Have a prayer and set off a vigil, and let's take action right now.
I heard there were three Shabbats today on site at the ICE center. And last night, actually, there were Aztec dancers. There was a drum circle. So there's been, you know, various forms of spiritual expression here.
Yes.
Am I missing ones? Have clergy been around? Have you noticed other?
No, you hit everything on the spot. It takes a lot of work to create a space that welcomes anyone. We're just about family, and we're all family.
Can you say more about why you feel so strongly about this issue?
We don't want a violent world. If you're a person who has had a life in hardship from street life, I hear you and I see you. We don't want a violent world. I'm also a Chicano. My father came from Mexico as a migrant worker. I am the oldest son of a migrant worker. I grew up with these workers. I also work in a place that advocates for workers' rights.
Yeah, what is keeping you going, Antonio? You must be absolutely exhausted.
My heart.
How long have you been down here?
I just got here today. Today was my first opportunity to get down here. So.
Yes. So what brought you down?
I wanted to show my support for this. I thought about I work for a Jewish assisted living facility. So in my facility, I've got a lot of Holocaust survivors, people who were actual refugees from overseas. And I talk to them a lot, obviously. And I thought about what I wanted to be able to say in 50 years when people ask me what I was doing right now.
How long have you been here today?
Today I've been here for about, I'd say, 3 hours now.
So what's the best part of it been for you? Like, what's most meaningful about being down here?
The best part, I think, was actually the Shabbat service that we had this evening. We had a rabbi get up, and we got to hear them singing and offering evening prayers and everything, and that was a really moving service. Everyone's been so friendly. You can really feel that there's really a lot of positive energy here, and so that's been really nice. A lot of protests, they have a more aggressive energy, but this one really doesn't. You know, you can tell people are kind of settling in for the long haul.
And during the Shabbat, were connections made between the Holocaust and this experience and the ICE actions? And
They talked about Passover. They talked about how we are all accountable for our neighbors and how we need to try to do justice. We need to act in love for our fellow man. We need to remember everybody's humanity, and that is the reason that we're here.
Tuesday, June 26th.
I'm talking to Alyssa Pariah. Been at the Poor People's Campaign for a little while now.
Yeah, I've been working at the state level in Oregon. The Poor People's Campaign works by the states that come together. So we've done actions, weekly actions in Salem, along with people in the other participating states that have been doing actions at their capital. And that was during the 40 days of Moral Fusion direct action. And that culminated with people from the states all converging on the National Mall in D.C., where we had a tent and held it down for a week. And finished with a mass rally where there were 15,000 people. And there were people from all over the country and across the political spectrum that came together to decry poverty and its impact, and that it is being put on people rather than a sort of personal failing. We know that that's not true, so we were very happy to be able to lift that up in D.C. So it killed me while I was gone that I couldn't be here for Occupy ICE PDX, which is where we're at now, but I'm very happy to be here now and catch up with comrades.
Yeah, and what connections are you making between the Poor People's Campaign and the encampment that's going on here?
Yeah, so one of the pieces that I know often gets sidelined, and this is, you know, through no fault of our own, because we have to do triage right now, so we have to, you know, do occupations to stop people from destroying families and kidnapping children. But I think a point that is often missed when we're talking about this is that the immigrant, you know, as a category of person, is always a scapegoat that's used when a society is in decline or when there is a impending crisis. And that is very clearly what's happening now. The truth of the matter is that the ruling elite in this country love cheap immigrant labor, or should I say cheapened immigrant labor. All labor has dignity, but tell that to a capitalist. So to be able to pit both, to conquer each, is an old tactic that is being used right now to get people that are our citizens, born in the U.S., to feel that people that are coming from Mexico, Central and South America, and Latin America are somehow a threat, and that is a very vicious tactic that's being used, and it's actually something that keeps us all poor, because if we band together, of course, the ruling elite wouldn't have a chance.
So when did you get back here? How long have you been at the camp?
So I just got here today. This is my first day, and I just got back to Portland, and I'm so happy to be back for as long as we can hold the camp. We know that DHS is doing all sorts of gnarly things right now, looking at us right now with binoculars and probably doing all sorts of preparations to try to stop our movement, but we're going to do what we can to keep it.
Yeah. How would you describe the vibe in the camp right now? What's your sense of the community?
Yeah, I think people are doing their best to lean on one another to keep strength and keep calm, and that is the best that we can do right now, because we know that the state has no scruples. So even though we are not currently under physical attack, I don't think any of us would be surprised if it happened at any moment, because that is the system that we're up against, no doubt.
Yeah. And a lot of these people have been here night after night and are pretty sleep deprived in some cases.
Yes, and thank you to everyone. I'm looking at some of my comrades now who are sleep deprived, and thank you very much for your tireless work, and to the best of your abilities, try to take care of yourself and do the hard work in organizing that we often forget, where you train someone to do what you do, so that if it's an issue of you being sleep deprived or you have an emergency, we want to be able to keep these things going without you if need be. So that means training people up to do the jobs. As soon as I got here today, I was asking how do I help organize the kitchen, the free clothes, the tent, the front table. I want to know how to do all of that, so that if one of my comrades who's been doing that work gets exhausted or has an emergency, then we can still be sustainable.
Danielle James.
How are you doing, Danielle?
I'm doing. I've been out here. This is day 9 for me. We're still pretty steadfast, still strong. The Homeland Security, they come around and they do these raids and they disturb the peace around here. Dealing with that kind of makes things hard to be around, but like I said, we have a very unwavering group of people around here, a very strong group of people, so we're standing strong and we're going to be here until we get what we want. It's common sense that this needs to be abolished, essentially. I've been oppressed myself, and so I know what it's like to have people hate you just because of your color and not know who you are and think that you're less than human being. So my heart bleeds for people in that position.
You know, some people might think that might make you less likely to put yourself out like this.
No. I'm human. And at the end of the day, we all bleed red blood. And
this occupation is having a profound effect. I mean, it's mobilized people all over the country. I mean, not that people weren't organizing anyway, but this specific form.
Right, this specific form of protest, I think, needed to happen in order for people who are not paying attention to wake up and realize that there are some problems going on and we need to fix them.
How did you feel when you first heard about them separating the families and some of what they're doing with these kids?
I mean, naturally, it made me sick to my stomach. My heart broke, but wasn't until, not that I didn't care, but the extra hurt and the heavy go down there and do something came when I'm actually hearing audio of these children and seeing the numbers of how many are lost. And I just wonder, like, what about their safety? Like, who's caring about these children? And so this is not my occupation. I'm not an organizer of this occupation. I just came down to help, and I'm planning on being here until it's all over. Imagine how these people are doing us from inside the building and taunting us and antagonizing the protesters out front and shooting them with pepper balls. Like, you're doing all this, I can only imagine. That's, like I said, what about the safety of the kids? Only heard that audio of those children and them making fun of those children because that's what the media wants us to see. But people know when you're sick, you're sick. And sick people need to not be around children. They need to not have positions of power. It's just heartbreaking.
On Thursday, June 28th, following the morning arrests of 8 protesters who'd locked down in front of the ICE building, hundreds of people turned out for the evening vigil. I spoke with activist Olivia, whose parents emigrated from El Salvador to Canada.
Understanding what my parents went through is really important. And with lots of family members who were part of the left, I know what it's like to be carrying that torch.
Yeah, and I mean, when I think a lot of people are like, oh, they feel like, you know, it's just all just started with Trump, right? But you, what the U.S. did in El Salvador in supporting death squads and supporting such extreme repression was, you know, that history. Not enough people know it.
I mean, Clinton, Obama, Reagan, Trump, Bush, they all continued this legacy, and none of them said, you know, this is unethical. All of them carried that torch. And like it or not, we don't have a real party that's advocating against that kind of policy. You have a long legacy of disenfranchising third world countries, removing democratically elected leaders, destroying the left, destroying unions. Do you know why the U.S. got involved in El Salvador? Because people wanted to get paid more for your coffee and your sugar and your bananas. And that's what I was saying up there is like, every time the same police and the protesters too, I mean everybody, they all use sugar, they all drink coffee, we all have bananas. Thank God I have a banana in the morning. Like, I know it's stupid, but it's a luxury that we have in the United States, not because bananas grow here in Oregon, they don't. Where does your chocolate come from? Like, where does all this food come from? Who picks the fruit that grows here for you? Every meal you have, you are literally enjoying the fruit of immigrant labor and of third world labor. And what do we do to award that? Do you think that forever these people are just going to say, okay, we make the food? There's more of them than there are of you. There's more of us than there are of you. So eventually, people realize that they're being exploited when they have the resources. So El Salvador realized, hey, we have the coffee, we have the sugar, we have all the goods. And these, you know, European people are coming in and taking all of our resources, and they don't give anything back. They give us a few cents and they leave with all of our food, and that's not good for us. We don't get to eat. I mean, the FMLN is the Farabundo Martí Liberación Nacional. So that's like a group based on a man named Farabundo Martí, and he was a labor advocate. And I think it has a lot to do with what's going on in the United States in terms of labor. I mean, today your Supreme Court delivered a huge blow to labor unions, which is one of the first moves of a fascist government. I mean, the Nazis immediately criminalized unions. The Nazis built camps, and then they built trains to those camps. This is what the United States is doing. They're making so many camps that they have to build unique trains just to go to those camps. They took away children from their parents. This isn't how it begins. This is like three steps in, four steps in. This isn't even a beginning. This is full-on fascism, and people are talking about civility, and they don't want to fight, and they want people to be quiet and nice and vote, and why didn't you vote for Hillary, and all this other stuff. But this is not the time for voting or not voting. If you voted for whoever, come and put yourself on the line. If you believe in what you voted for, come and put yourself on the line. It doesn't matter anymore who voted for what. It matters what you're doing today. I don't live in the past. I live here on the front line.
Yeah, for people who can't see what you mean by that.
I mean, yeah. So here, I don't know who these people voted for, and frankly, I don't care, because a lot of us can't even vote in this country. The people who are doing something to challenge fascism are standing in between me and people like me and fascist forces. These are men dressed like stormtroopers with AK-47s defending detention centers that divide families. That is your enemy, not the leftists, not what you call the Bernie Sanders people, not the Hillary supporters. You need to be unified. Your enemy is the guy with the AK on top of the detention center. And what are you doing to stop him today, physically? Where are you?
This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mall Variety Hour.
And thank you, Desiree, for all the work that she put into gathering and organizing that material for you here on the Old Mole Variety Hour. You're heard on KBOO, your listener-sponsored radio station. I'm Clayton Margridge, and KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listeners, members, and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Scholarships and other tuition opportunities are available. Course options and more information online at PUGS, that's PUGSPDX.com. Next up on the Old Mo, we're going to look at borders and immigration as represented in a new animated film, Coco. Joe Clement and Jan Hocken review the 2017 animated film Coco, which blends an age-old story of a child's torn affection for family and the wider world with a trauma narrative about a family wound. They consider the deep emotional resonance as themes of borders, family separation, the toxicity of worldly wealth, and integrating alienated aspects of ourselves. Here's Jan.
Pixar's newest animated film, Coco, released in 2017, was meant to be a love letter to Mexico. Some reviewers actually have called Coco subversive, rebellious, for celebrating Mexican culture in the current political climate, at a time when President Trump is trying to build his wall between the countries. Musician Camila Lara says the movie sends an alternative vision. This is showing the Mexico I like, he says, the Mexico that is creative and fun and exciting and full of culture and culture, not the Mexico full of violence and the narco Mexico that Trump so famously is trafficked in. The movie has a Latino cast. It's full of Mexican music, culture, and folklore, including some of the traditions around the Day of the Dead, and it premiered in Mexico last fall, where it's gone to become the number one film of all time. The story follows 12-year-old Miguel Rivera, who yearns to be a great musician, but he has to hide his ambition and his guitar from his family of shoemakers who don't approve. No music, he's continually reminded by relatives who believe music cursed the family. And the film unfolds as Miguel attempts to escape this curse and the binding ties of family. So, Joe, what do you make of this central theme? Because, of course, the story of a child, typically a boy, who attempts to emancipate himself from binding kinship ties, pursuing possibilities on the horizon beyond the kinship fold, is a very old one, and often there are particular Western modern versions of this story. But let's start with the story we see in this film, Coco.
So this is, in a lot of ways, a trauma story. It is a story about going beyond the family's boundaries, but there in this story is a trauma which helps to, I think, kind of literalize the feeling of just total abandonment and upset that separation entails, both for the person going away and the people that they're going away from. And in trying to search out his roots in his quest to become a musician, Miguel is kind of going into his family's history for his family's sake, and he doesn't change anything except what was understood about the past. And there is this very kind of beautiful resolution in the end where Miguel's pursuit of music and his family member who was a musician become reintegrated into the family, into its own story and living conception of itself, so that they can have both the outward seeking individual respecting part of their family and then the tradition and their memory of that.
And some anthropologists would say that a difference between the pre-capitalist traditional story where the child explores a world beyond the kinship system and has some tests of various kind, often this is a male story of a quest to test yourself beyond the world of familial obligation. And then the denouement is that you return to the family, you return to the fold. In the Western canon, often the boy leaves and does not return. So you have here this, spoiler alert, the boy does return at the end to the familial fold. And so it carries a lot of that, the pre-capitalist commitments to familial ties that we see in immigrants also who are in this film. There's a lot of border crossing of the on the Day of the Dead that evokes our knowledge today of how difficult the border and the passport control is for people who are stopped at the borders, poor people from the South. And so the film works with border agents in a playful, animated way, but it's it of course is read through the present where there is painful trauma happening for families separated at the border. And so the film has a kind of eerie timeliness in that way. And I think the way in which the boy's quest and those who've departed still have obligations to the living, and the living have obligations to those who've gone before, is something you see in immigrant communities here. How many people, immigrant communities, send much of what they make back home across the border? How many immigrant communities around the world are supported by immigrants here? And that's not the capitalist ideal of the family, you know, where the children are much more expected to move on in the world and not return. So the film, I think, does carry the endorse in a way the right of children to follow their dreams, to leave. But it's a very ambivalent film in that way, and I think expresses a lot of the ambivalence that many people feel about the right to pursue your dream and to leave people behind, and the trauma, particularly of men who abandon their families, which was the central, as you said, the trauma of, that the film starts with.
And that's what's so interesting about the film. Another spoiler alert. Miguel decides that this famous musician, Ernesto de la Cruz, who's from his hometown, which is named after the patron saint of musicians, is his great-great-grandfather, and that explains what happened in his family. There's this guitar that matches a photo that he has off the ofrenda, the headless photo. And once he gets stuck in the land of the dead, he thinks that, oh, my family here is still not going to accept me as a musician and give me their blessing so I can return to the land of the living. I will go to my family member who is a musician. And what he ends up discovering about Ernesto de la Cruz is that he stole his great-great-grandfather's songs and murdered him. And he does this by way of meeting his great-great-grandfather unwittingly. What he comes to realize about Ernesto de la Cruz is that this vanity, this very vain man who will kill him, this is what his family feared he'd become. It's what he ended up valorizing for so long. And then he comes to realize that, no, there is a certain kind of detached from others, a very individualistic notion of this worldliness.
He has to de-idealize the object of his search, and that there was something true in the admonitions of the mother and the grandmothers, that there was something, it wasn't only a prohibition based on their neurotic overreaction, but that there was something destructive about the lure of fame.
Yeah, and Ernesto de la Cruz kills Miguel's great-great-grandfather, Hector, and so there was no possibility of reconciling, of forgiving for the initial time that he leaves. Ultimately, the film gets back to that place, but it's after he's died. But then it manifests in the family with the reintegration of just allowing music around, and it's not just Miguel. There's other people in the family who play music. It's a way of resolving that tension that doesn't go either or. It's how do we make space for change and for newness.
Yeah, and it ends with forgiving but not forgetting, you know, playing or exploring some of the conflict about people you love who let you down. This is Jan Hawken and Joe Clement talking this morning about the animated film Coco, and I would like to talk about the title of the film, which is about the grandmother who is in a state of dementia, kind of absent. It's not clear whether initially she's depressed or suffering dementia. And the film is named after her. And then at the end, she speaks. And I think in the reviews, focusing so much on Miguel the boy, who's very enchanting in this film, the matrilineal aspect of the film as it's represented can get kind of lost, particularly as you see this, the very harsh grandmother, you know, disciplining the boy, but also hugging him and holding him tight, and how that practice of holding your children tight but also disciplining them comes out of a maternal authority grounded in the material conditions of life. Throughout much of human history until the rise of industrial capitalism, households were economic units of production, and the authority of mothers was grounded in the survival of kinship systems in their communities that were productive units, as well as places where children were raised. And with the rise of capitalism, the authority of women within the household was greatly devalued because production no longer was so grounded in the family. And so you see here a version of authority passed from mother down a, it's still patriarchal, larger society, but matrilineal in the sense of women carry authority passed on through their skills in as producers. But I think part of the resonance of the film was the way in which many households around the world still do have considerable female authority located within that family because women are producers. But that also, and the disciplinary aspect of that maternal authority is strengthened by the threat of all of the call of capitalism, you know, the lure of wealth and fame beyond the community. And it's very much a cautionary tale on that level that still, I think, resonates with people.
I want to respond to what you said about Coco and just notice also how she is one of the only two people in this story who actually knew Hector. And in a certain way, Imelda and the memory that Imelda as the mother in that situation passed down ends up being the one with all the pain of hate of and that hate being the fuel of the prohibition, while Coco remembers her father as a child can only remember their father, and she probably maybe heard things from her mother, but
and she received something from him.
She did the song and you know, Hector, the in version of the Land of the Dead, if someone in the living forgets you and there's no one else to carry on your stories, then you disappear, the final death, they put it. And this is going to happen to Hector because his picture has been taken off of the family ofrenda for so long. And so getting back for Miguel is also about getting this picture back onto the ofrenda, about letting Mama Coco know that her father loved her. And the way that she kind of comes to in the end is, for me, very much a matter of finally coming to terms with, like, what happened with her papa, and really getting a message from her papa. And that's what Miguel says, you know, your father wanted you to have this. And like Miguel earlier in the film, who was admonished by his grandmother for having a secret he kept from the family, Mama Coco has her own secret, which is kind of the complement to this secret that is coming out about the family and about Miguel.
I think one reading could be that the younger grandmother is more frightened of the world and holding things together than an earlier generation who still receives something in her case, the father who was still together enough to give to his daughter, and that had a kind of psychological validity to it, that people who live under conditions where maybe parents leave or suffer in various ways, but they have something to give their children that they can hold tight in the world, versus children who come into adulthood under conditions where life is much harder. And of course, we're seeing those differences played out all the time in the world. Children suffering more trauma than they can bear, and parents not being able to give as much to their children as their children need to hold on. And our government now is very much producing trauma for people.
Yeah, I mean, this film is all about generational trauma and how it reproduces itself.
Yeah.
Not necessarily with a sociological perspective, but just how it can travel through generations and it have this kind of practical concrete. We see what's happening and how it keeps reproducing itself, but nonetheless kind of elusive and intangible.
And I also think it's very difficult to talk with children about death, and a lot of religions perpetuate forms of terrorism about hell. You're burned in hell if you don't abide by the faith, which I consider a form of psychological terrorism, to tell children that, that there's a being is going to torture you forever if you don't obey. There's none of that in this film. It really is a kind of secular film in a way. It's about how the people who die or held live only as long as the memories of people who hold them in mind, and that we have an obligation not only to remember the dead in some sentimental way, but to remember what they've taught us. And this is about what do we have to know about the kind of the warning signs in the world and the cautionary tales of people who've gone before. So it's a debt to them. And yet the old aren't over romanticized either in this film, because they also were fools in many cases. So there's an incredible variety of people in the land of the dead. And it's a quite remarkable film for coming out of a profit-driven industry like Pixar, owned by Disney. But I think perhaps is a response to the country getting browner.
And whatever its limits, we think that you should go see this film, but try to see it for free. You can get it through the Multnomah County Library, and it's going to be showing a number of times in the parks. Go to Portland Parks and Rec and look for free movies in the park, and look for Coco. It's showing a couple times in July and August. This has been Joe Clement and Jan Hocken talking about Coco.
And thanks, Jan and Joe. Well, you should know that Coco is available at the Multnomah County Library, and it will be shown on some big screens in Portland Parks this summer. We'll post details of that on the KBOO website on the page for today's show. Well, to close out today's show, Bill Resnick will be on the phone with Bob Peterson, I'm not sure if he's gotten through to him yet. Let me let you know right now then that at 10 o'clock on KBOO, stay tuned to KBOO after the Old Mole, for Locust Focus, that will look at the new forests emerging in the gorge after the Eagle Creek fire. And at 11 on Making Contact, Beyond Stonewall, the push for LGBTQ civil rights. At 11:30, Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. And now here's Bill to talk with Bob Peterson, who was active in the Milwaukee Association of Teachers during the struggle to save public unions against the anti-labor campaign of Governor Scott Walker a couple years ago. Here's Bill.
Yeah, in fact, Clayton, he led the way, president of the, during that great assault on teachers. Bob Peterson, welcome to KBOO.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Bob Peterson taught fifth grade in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for 30 years. He was, again, the president of the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association through the most difficult period of fighting the right-wing legislature and government and governor as they attempted to destroy all unions, but particularly the teachers. He also co-founded the organization Rethinking Schools and was an editor. It's a wonderful magazine. He writes and speaks a lot. Through the years of struggle, he's really in demand as a speaker, because through the years of struggle in Wisconsin, the union was in many ways weakened, but in many ways it grew stronger and showed the way to the new teacher unionism that is now emerging around the country. So, Bob Peterson, do you miss your fifth? Well, before we get to the business, do you miss your fifth graders?
I do, very much so. I had so much interaction with fifth graders over the 30 years, and not only just teaching and learning from them, but sharing with them the need for us all to be concerned with social justice issues. My kids organized clubs against the war, the Iraq war, clubs to save the neighborhood swimming pool and to save their library. And I believe now that more than ever that students need to be encouraged to speak up and act.
Yeah, and with their parents, I understand, in your school.
Oh, yeah, the parents. I like to think of schools as the greenhouses of democracy. That's what we should have them as, both how they run internally and what they stand for, with parents, teachers, and students united to get justice in our community and the greater world.
Yeah, I guess that's why they elected you president for all those very tough years, because you had that vision. Anyway, Bob, let's get down to the current struggles. Tell us about Wisconsin and teaching, and what happened to the unions in Wisconsin, and also the recent Supreme Court decision, Janus, which was anticipated in Wisconsin by, 6 or 8 years, by the Wisconsin legislature, and even worse than Janus. And then we can get how the teachers' union survived and in many ways strengthened. But first, what happened?
Yeah, well, in Wisconsin, as you said, It was at Act 10. It was the spring of 2011, and Walker, to quote his own words, dropped a bomb on public sector workers. You know, he has since then attacked private sector workers, even though at the time he said he wasn't going to. But basically, what happened in Wisconsin, Act 10, is sort of Janus on steroids, Janus being the Supreme Court ruling that you mentioned that prohibits now unions from collecting agency fees for people who don't join the union but benefit from the union. I call them freeloaders. But anyway, in Wisconsin, we lost that right, the agency fee issue, but we also lost the right to collectively bargain. Bargaining could only include base wage increases, not to exceed the cost of living. When I was president, that was for 2 years, it was 0% cost of living increases, so that was all we could bargain. We also lost the right to dues checkoff, like, so instead of having it deducted from a payroll check, we had to go out and individually ask people for their bank account number. And on top of that, they have instituted a recertification program, which means every year we have to pay money, actually, to have the state run a recertification election for our union. And anybody who doesn't vote is considered a no vote. So it's not 51% of those people who vote or 50% plus one. It is actually 51% of the entire unit that you're trying to represent. So we were really challenged post Act 10, and the prediction was that the unions would basically disappear. Now, the fact is, some unions did almost disappear, and the amount of money that unions could contribute to, say, think tanks, progressive think tanks, and candidates did decline, which was certainly one of the goals of the Republicans. But the fact of the matter is, there was a silver lining to this, which is people really got pissed off. People who protested came back to their hometown saying, look, we're not going to let Walker or anybody else destroy our unions. And in many cases, we started rethinking how unions should operate, because quite frankly, unions had been defined so narrowly in the minds of members. You negotiate a contract, you enforce that contract, and sort of a business style union. If you had a problem, you called up the staff person, like you call up an insurance agent. And so our approach was what we called social justice unionism and an organizing model, where you really get elected leaders and members very active in both determining policy in the union and implementing them.
Yeah, and you were quite successful in Milwaukee in many ways, in the social justice unionism and in what you called not collective bargaining, but collective action. Let me give a station ID and reintroduce you, and then we'll get into how you succeeded to some extent in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin, and how that contributed to so many of this emerging struggles in West Virginia and Arizona and Kentucky and Oklahoma, all right the work states, incidentally, where the unions had were not allowed, in fact, to get mandatory dues from their members. So this is the OMO Variety Hour. Bill Resnick here. I'm talking to Bob Peterson, 30 years a fifth grade teacher, co-founder of the organization Rethinking Schools, president then of the Milwaukee Teachers Union, in its years battling for teachers and students, being the assault on them by the right wing. We've discussed the right wing strategy and what they did in Wisconsin, which was in fact more draconian, much more draconian. In fact, Bob, I'm not sure, why didn't they go at teacher tenure, and or did they? We'll talk about that. The right wing won a lot of battles. It's not at all clear right now that, and we're showing signs that the right wing might in fact be losing the war, or could well lose the war. So tell us again, tell us how you fought back in Milwaukee and the gains that you made, and particularly the gains in building a different kind of union.
Right. And so what actually, when we got elected, it was me and a number of progressive people on our executive board, we did a campaign to reimagine our union. And we said, we had to reimagine it in different ways. One is with the decline of collective bargaining, we had to replace that with collective action. We had to involve our membership in a much more different way. Our communications had to improve, their involvement in committee possibilities had to improve, their activities had to improve. And that meant a lot of one-on-one conversations in building the capacity of our local school leaders, we call them building representatives, to organize within their own buildings. But the sort of the conception of the union also changed from one that just focused on bread and butter issues and was sort of staff driven to one that was what we call social justice union that had three central components or legs, like legs of a stool. You can't have a stool with two legs or one leg. One leg, though, is bread and butter issues. Obviously, unions have to look out for their members, and that's an important thing. A second leg is basically pedagogy. We have to take responsibility for what's going on in our classrooms, and we have to promote amongst our members and publicly in terms of policy things that will allow us professionals to reclaim our classroom and this obsession with standardized testing and scripted curriculum and really promote student-focused learning where kids are engaged in projects and really looking at the world. And then the third leg of the stool is social justice. So we have to stand for social justice both within our schools but also within our community. We can't think that if we just look out for our own selves, and this is true of all public sector workers and in fact private sector workers too, that our interests are not just bound up in our members but in the whole entire working class and oppressed communities in our neighborhoods, and we have to stand with them. So we got involved in a variety of union coalitions and encourage our members to participate in everything from securing immigrant rights in our schools through a sanctuary movement to supporting the Black Lives Matters struggles in Milwaukee, supporting other workers who are on strike, like immigrant workers at a pizza factory and the local transit workers. And in so doing, not just having two people from the leadership go out and make a speech, but really getting people involved and tying our struggle to their struggle. What that has occurred, I mean, there's some simple things. I mean, a lot of people, you know, we're about to give up at the end of Act 10 when all that went down. And we took it little bit by little bit, whether it was increasing teacher time, so planning time, because we lost a lot of that immediately following Act 10. Or like one thing we demanded was that there be daily mandatory playtime, uninterrupted playtime for a four-year-old and five-year-old kindergarten.
Yeah, Bob, that was so interesting. I read it. So amazing. They were just grinding at kids with their little formulas and absurd rote learning, and they didn't even have a playtime for 4- and 5-year-olds. I mean, there's something Dickensian about that.
It seems crazy that
you have to fight for that.
Right. And in fact, we did. It was a collective fight. It was with parents. It was with professional, you know, university people who know about early child education, of course, teachers and paraprofessionals, and were just outraged. But it's a symptom of what's going on in this country still. I mean, we test kids more than any other country in the world, and our curriculum is driven by these corporate textbooks and corporate texting companies. And most, unfortunately, many school boards and administrators have swallowed the Kool-Aid and think that's the only way you can assess our students. I'm all for making sure we have a rigorous curriculum and kids learn a lot, but this is not working the way we're doing. So anyway, so we mobilized people around those professional issues, and that brought people back into our union and wanted and made people real advocates for us. We have also, you know, continued to recently this administration was going to cut all schools' budgets by 5%. The union under new leadership now, you know, I'm retired from that. They protested and got that completely restored, and instead pushed the school board and worked with progressive school board members to cut from the top and cut millions of dollars off of the central office administration in order to fund the schools. Now, obviously, the biggest problem is the state. Right now in Wisconsin, we're looking at a November election and trying to get rid of Walker. There's no term limits for governors in Wisconsin. And if he continues, it's going to be a real war here. Hopefully, we'll be able to replace him with somebody who, well, anybody would be better. Anyway.
Let's talk about the teachers, and we only have a couple more minutes. The Wisconsin Spirit actually was one of those precursors to what happened in West Virginia and so many other states. Tell us about that, and give us a sense of how, let's say, the Boston teachers and their struggles, and other teachers in other cities, in Chicago in particular, have reached out to their communities.
Right. I think what's really exciting right now in the teacher union movement is the sort of both established union leaders and rank and file are rising up. I know that the Chicago teachers unions were inspired by the uprising in Wisconsin in 2011. They went on to have a very successful strike where they united with parents. Teachers in Seattle did the same a couple of years later. Teacher leaders in Boston, Raleigh, North Carolina, Los Angeles have become real leaders in this vision of social justice unionism. And then on top of it, obviously, this spring, we saw rank and file in what are called red or purple states just saying enough is enough. And it was both economic and all this crap in terms of testing and control of the teachers' lives. And they rose up. And ultimately, I think in most of those states, the unions got on board and were helpful. But it indicated to me that the unions should have been doing more just from the beginning. But it also, and most importantly, it shows the power of organized rank and file members. And a lot of them continue to be involved. Some have formed caucuses to push their union leadership to stand with not only teachers, all teachers, but also other staff at schools and the community in demanding that schools be adequately funded. Because a lot of this direct attack on schools by those people who would like to destroy public education, whether it's the oil interests in Oklahoma or coal interests in West Virginia. They have no interest in promoting quality public education, and that's nationwide.
Bob, tell us we have a minute, Rethinking Schools, your recent article that's on the Rethinking Schools blog is well worth reading. Also, I want to urge you not to retire from the struggle.
I won't. Yes, our new issue of Rethinking Schools, our summer issue, actually has three articles about the teacher struggle. One is mine, Transforming Teacher Unions in a Post-Janus World. That's available right now if you go to Rethinking Schools blog. But there's also an article about the struggle in Puerto Rico, and there's another article about the going into depth about the uprisings in the red states in Virginia and West Virginia and North Carolina and so on and so forth. So yeah, go to rethinkingschools.org. We need subscribers, and please check us out, but view us as part of the movement for educational justice, because we are and will continue and will work with people throughout the country.
Yeah, let me give you a brief 10-second promo. For teachers or parents, Rethinking Schools has the most interesting curriculums and books that you can imagine in terms of rethinking not just schools, but the whole of American history that they reinterpreted. These are wonderful books and done very well. Thank you so much, Bob.
Well, thank you.
Right, so long.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And thank you, Bob and Bill. And that concludes today's Old Mole Variety Hour. Many thanks to Desiree Helligers for her work in the field and the studio to produce her report from the protests at ICE headquarters. Thanks also to our movie moles, Jan Hocken and Joe Clement, for their discussion of the movie Coco, and to Bill Resnick and his guest, Bob Peterson, for their conversation about the upsurge of teacher unions. You can hear any of this again, either the whole show or the separate parts of it, by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Today's show should be up in a day or two, or at the end of the week at the latest. Follow the Old Mole on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer is Patsy Kullberg. And tune in again next Monday morning at 9 for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground perspective.
with...
First off, they'll say what it is, a festival.
Hey, folks, I want to tell you about the first annual Best of the Northwest Vernonia Springs Music Festival. It's going to take place on July 7th, 2018. KBOO is our co-sponsor, and our headliners are Lloyd Jones and Baby Gramps.
Sometimes known as Sourdough Dolly.
Well, you give him a purge of that good old Mountain Dew.
www.vernoniasprings.com/VSMF. To learn more, go to kboo.fm.
And people think, he's so old, he squeaks. And I will prove that.
Look for the Vernonia Springs Music Festival.
And I'd like to convert it into a bedlam of jive. Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
KBOO Community Radio is proud to broadcast the 31st Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place from July 4th through 7th at Waterfront Park in Portland. KBOO will be broadcasting the festival from noon to about 10 p.m. every day, and will be broadcasting throughout the state on or